Hi, thank you so much. My name is June. I'm an alcoholic, and thank you very much for allowing me to be a part of your conference today. And thank you so much to Philo and this whole committee, you know, for all the service that you're doing for so many. I really also want to thank so many members of my home group, my international home group, The Back Porch, that is an online group, and I have not been this excited about a group in a while. So I really appreciate it, especially a lot of them are staying up late because it's on the East Coast, most of them. And you know, one of the members, Tommy, he's celebrating his birthday this month and he'll have 57 years. And I think this is, I heard a rumor, this is the sixth meeting he's been to today. I was joking with my husband earlier. I was saying, you know, I think that the reason that Tommy with 57 years and a lot of you know Joan with 63 years, I think the reason they're so happy is they keep going to 5 or 6 meetings a day. I think Mark and I are only going to like 3. I don't think we're keeping up with the old timers. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been given a life that I never would have wanted. And I'm a person that I wouldn't have even liked when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. So it has really been an amazing adventure for me. I want to welcome any of you who are new or relatively new. And I want to start out by saying the same thing I always say when I'm asked to share in this capacity, because I believe it to be the most important thing that I say, no matter how long I am talking here. And I'm just checking to make sure my timer did start. It did. Okay. You know, most important thing that I'll say, since I can't always listen, even today, I don't always listen to everything the speaker is saying, you know, because you know how they can go on, and I have to think about myself a lot of the time. So in case you're anything like me, the most important thing I'm going to say tonight is that I am not an expert on alcoholism, on Alcoholics Anonymous, on any step, on any page in the big book, on anything. I'm just a member. I'm going to share my experience, strength, and hope. I owe a debt to Alcoholics Anonymous that I will never be able to repay. And I owe a debt in Alcoholics Anonymous to thousands of people who showed up to come and talk at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous when they could have stayed home and watched Monday Night Football, when they could have, you know, had dinner with their family, when they could have done lots of other things instead of driving across the country or across the state or flying or whatever they were doing to get to meetings. Because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no place else to go. I went to 21 meetings a week, most of my first 2.5 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, not because I was trying to be a star in AA, but because I had absolutely no place else to go that was indoors. And I cannot honestly tell you what most of those people said in those thousands of meetings that I went to. But the thing is that they showed up. And they tried to give back to Alcoholics Anonymous what had been freely given to them. And that's one of the reasons that I continue to show up when I am asked, even if I'd rather not on certain occasions, you know, or I don't feel like it. You know, I'm looking at my friend Pat, you know, and from Texas, and, you know, always makes me think of, you know, this line I heard once from a guy in Texas. He said, if you like everyone in AA, you're probably not going to enough meetings. And, I think about that because, you know, I need to show up in Alcoholics Anonymous, even sometimes when I don't feel like it, when I don't like somebody, when I don't like me, you know, when I don't like how things are going in my life. But yesterday at my home group, someone read the 5th chapter. And let me see if I can get this. They read, "Rarely have we seen a person who has thoroughly followed our path." And I thought, you know, that's absolutely true. I don't think that it is rare that we've seen someone thoroughly follow our path. And I certainly have not thoroughly followed this path at all times. What I have done 100% perfectly is since I came in and got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't taken anything that affects me from the neck up. That's how I personally define sobriety. I've done that one day at a time. I've done that since the 13th of July, 1972. And that means that I just this week celebrated 48 and a half years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to assure you, particularly if you're new, that I never planned on staying sober for 48 years when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I never planned on living that long. And honestly, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because I couldn't die. I really tried to die for a long time before I came here. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know how I was going to stay here and not drink. And I knew I couldn't drink anymore. And so I was at the jumping off place that it talks about, you know, for us in the big book about Alcoholics Anonymous. The other thing I always like to remember to mention to say when I'm asked to share like this, because people come to Alcoholics Anonymous in many different ways. Back when I got sober, most people came in either through a family member or perhaps a judge or a doctor or a traditional 12-step call, which we seem to have, of course, fewer and fewer of those. And of course, we still get some members from those places, but more and more people come in through different kinds of hospitals or detoxes or treatment centers or whatever they might be called. And it really doesn't matter, I don't think, how anybody gets to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, once you're here. But because it can get confusing sometimes about which part is the program that you came from and which part is Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd like to let you know, if you're new or visiting, that Alcoholics Anonymous itself is absolutely free. If Alcoholics Anonymous had not been free, I couldn't have come here. And if Alcoholics Anonymous had not stayed free, I couldn't have stayed. I was over 10 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous before I could afford to put a dollar in the basket at the seventh tradition. And I haven't been able to put a dollar in the basket all the times since I was 10 years sober. So I just want you to know, if you're new, this is not about money. And that's been very, very important to me. At the same time, you know, that being said, we do have a seventh tradition in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did hear them making the announcement, you know, tonight about, you know, supporting this group and supporting Alcoholics Anonymous if you're able to and when you're able to. But unless and until that happens, please know that you are welcome, and this is not about money. I talked at a meeting, you know, a number of years ago at 26th and Broadway. This guy came up to me to thank me for talking, I think mainly because his sponsor was standing behind him and told him to. And he shook my hand and he said, I want to thank you for your story tonight. He goes, I don't really believe that was your story, but I like the way you told it. And that's my favorite thing anybody's ever said to me, because it's such a tribute to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I really want to assure you that I looked exactly like my story when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I looked like my story for a long time after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I grew up in an alcoholic home. I grew up in Venice, California. I grew up with a lot of violence. I grew up with a lot of other kinds of abuse happening in my life and in my home. And I grew up with a lot of broken promises that sometimes go with alcoholism being actively lived in a family. And by the time I was 5 years old, I found my first obsession. And that obsession was with the idea of suicide. I really needed out. Life just hurt way too much for me. And too many bad things had already happened. And I didn't want to be here anymore. And I began to try on a regular basis to find different ways to try and kill myself. And I did a lot of other things, you know, to try and hurt myself, you know, physically and otherwise, because it really hurt and I needed a way out. And I love the fact that later on when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I found out they were originally going to call the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous The Way Out, till they found out there were like 13 other books that were already called that. So they changed the name to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I needed a way out. And I began on a regular basis to try and take my own life and to cut my hands and fingers and wrists with razor blades and to take overdoses of baby aspirin, which was all I knew about at the time I was 5 years old. And luckily for me, by the time I was 8 years old, I began to drink on a regular basis. And I say luckily because I'm extremely grateful to alcohol. I needed a way out, and I needed a way to not hurt all the time. Because even at five, I could look and see it was not going to get better. I could look at the people that were older than me and I could see life was just going to get worse and there was going to be more violence and more terrible things happening. And so for me, luckily, alcohol worked the way that it talks about in the doctor's opinion. I got a special effect that most people do not get. Now, I don't have a lot of funny social drinking stories to tell you. I encourage you, if you are new in Alcoholics Anonymous, to go to a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, particularly right now while we're online, to take advantage of the fact that you can go to meetings all over the world. and especially with all the time zones, if you can't sleep, you can get to these different, you know, meetings, because I couldn't sleep for years after I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's really, I think, one of the greatest things that I hope that you get if you're new is to see that we are people who normally would not mix. And that is, I think, one of the greatest strengths of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's one of the things I've found to be great about it. So anyway, I started to drink on a regular basis when I was 8 years old. A year later or so, I found a way to mix that with chemicals that got me where I needed to go, which was completely out. I didn't want to feel good. I wanted to not feel anything at all. And I knew how to drink the way to do it. And I'm grateful that it worked for me. I do believe I would have had to been locked up in some kind of an institution if I hadn't found alcohol and it didn't work. You know, when I was growing up, I was raised Catholic, and I obviously was, you know, trying to kill myself and, you know, these kind of things. My family noticed it, and they took me to a priest to get some consultation, and the priest could tell, I guess, that I had some mental health issues or some kind of issues. And he suggested that they begin to take me to some professionals. And I've seen a few professionals, not as many as I'm sure just even on this screen might have seen. I've seen some. I don't have any kind of diagnosis to give you about what these well-meaning, I'm assuming, professionals would have liked to do to help me. Because I felt about those people like a woman I got sober with named Patty Hicks did. I thought these people should have to work for their money. And I never told them anything. I didn't fill out any papers. I didn't answer any questions, and I would not play with their dolls. So at the end of the 50 minutes, you know, we were done and nothing had transpired from me. And I just got up and I walked out. So, you know, I kind of learned for myself the way that I saw the world, you know, before coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't ever remember seeing a man cry under any circumstances. And in my life and in the bars that my mom drank in Venice, there were some very violent things that were going on. So I've seen men shot, I've seen them stabbed, I've seen a pool cue pushed through their head, I saw them get arrested, I saw their kids overdose, I saw a lot of stuff happen. I never saw a man cry that I remember before coming to AA. And I believed until long after I was in AA that that's because men don't feel pain. That's because nothing hurts men. Men only feel anger. And that's how I wanted to be, because I always felt pain. I felt way too much pain. And I thought, if I could be like a man, then I wouldn't feel pain and you couldn't hurt me anymore. And alcohol, to a certain extent, allowed me to not care. To not care about me and to not care about you, and allowed me to live with a lot of anger. And, you know, I grew up in, and as I said, in Venice Beach, and I wanted to be tough because I thought if I was tough and you thought I was tough, then you wouldn't be able to hurt me. I spent a lot of my life trying to make sure that you were more likely to punch me in my face than hurt my feelings. And I got punched in the face a lot. I knew exactly what to do and say to get that to happen. And it did happen a lot. You know, I like to mention, however, when I talk about being in a gang, that I've never won a fight in my life. But I never fought less than five people at a time. So I frequently had a black eye and a swollen lip or, you know, whatever, because I was always getting beat up. my mother is a person who was going to be in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for 40 years with varying lengths of sobriety. Tonight, my mother has continually been sober for 16 years now. But back then, she was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for many, many years. And so one of the times that my mother was coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous, she brought me to a meeting. And I didn't ask to go to that meeting. I didn't want to go to that meeting. I certainly didn't think I had a problem. I knew she had a problem. But she brought me to that meeting, and that was only because she thought if she left me alone, I might get her evicted from another apartment with some of the activities that I had going on with my friends. And so I came to that meeting. I did not get sober that night, but the miracle, I believe, for me began that night, because there was a guy in that meeting that I admired more than anybody else in the world, and I'm sure some of you won't even identify with why I would have admired him. But he was from the bar that my mother drank in, that really violent bar, only he won fights. My mom was like me. She never won fights, although she never fought anybody that wasn't a man and didn't outweigh her by 100 pounds. So she always lost too. But Paul, I had seen win fights, and he was at the meeting that night. And I was really impressed that someone who could win fights would come to AA. And I came to meetings the next couple of weeks, and I talked to Paul. He was the only person that I talked to. And I explained to Paul that I wasn't an alcoholic, that I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic, that I was too young to be an alcoholic, that I wasn't anything like my mother, who was an alcoholic. And I later found out that non-alcoholics don't have to spend any time trying to convince other people they're not alcoholic. They already know that, but I didn't know that then. And so I was doing that. And Paul turned to me and he said, you know, June, I'm new in AA. And they have told me I cannot diagnose anybody's disease but my own. He said, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception. He said, I've seen the way that you drink and I've seen the way that you use chemicals. And I happen to believe if you don't come into this program and take what these people have to offer you within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be out on the streets, you're going to be shooting stuff and you'll be selling your ass. And I knew he wasn't trying to like make up a story like the teacher in high school might do to scare kids about something they didn't know anything about. He was just talking about things that had happened or were beginning to happen in my life. And I thought a little bit about what he said, but I did not want to be an alcoholic. I did not want to join an organization that was allowing my mother to belong to it. But I found in those next 2 weeks that every option but Alcoholics Anonymous was removed from my life. My mother and I had a violent relationship when we were both drinking. My mother was getting sober and she did not think she had to be subjected to violent attacks anymore. And she asked me to leave and I did. My family did not talk to me again until I was almost 5 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous before I was invited back to different family events. Not just because of my drinking, but because of my stealing, my bad attitude, my violence. I'd been in a lot of foster homes and none of them would take me back. I tried to get into a couple of alcohol recovery homes that they had back then. There were only three that I remember right now that I think I contacted those three. None of them would take me, some because of my age and some just because of my attitude. And then I thought, well, you know what? Who cares? Who cares about families and who cares about, you know, foster homes, you know, all of that, because it doesn't really matter. The only thing that really matters if you're a tough brat is your gang. And then one day as I walked down an alley, all five members of my own gang beat me up. And so I found myself sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 87 pounds. I had a black eye. I had a swollen lip. I wasn't wearing shoes at the meeting. I had shoes. I just didn't wear them very often because I'm from Venice Beach and you have to have tough feet if you're from the beach. I raised my hand in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know tonight that there were some people in that meeting that did not know about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, in particular the third tradition, the one that says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And the reason I know they didn't know about that was because when I first raised my hand in that meeting, a couple of those people who knew my mother, because she'd been in and out of that group for many years, they knew who I was and how old I was. And they came over to me and they told me that they didn't want a little kid sitting in their meeting while they talked about serious things. And they told me if I came back that they would get together and throw me out. And I didn't know that Alcoholics Anonymous had a third tradition that said the only requirement for AA membership was a desire to stop drinking. I just thought the people in AA didn't want me either. And I didn't want me either. And I hadn't for a long time. So I fell back on my number one answer. The answer I'd been using since I was 5 years old. I went over to a friend of my mother's house. I went in her bathroom, which is the first place I went at any home I ever visited. And I took enough of the kind of pills to kill myself one more time. And then I went to a noon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And by the time I got to that noon meeting, they recognized that I needed to be taken to a hospital. And that was where I came to with a doctor having given me something to make me throw up and explained to me that the pills I had taken were to slow down my heart. And had I been there 5 or 10 minutes later, I would have been in a coma that they probably couldn't have brought me out of. And I don't know exactly why that overdose was any different than all the other overdoses I'd inflicted upon myself. I just know that it was, because since that time, I haven't taken anything that affects me from the neck up. Now, you know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous after that, after I walked out of that hospital, I got very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've stayed very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've done it a lot of the time with a terrible attitude, but I have shown up for my AA commitments. You know, that's what I was taught by my sponsor, is that you show up. My first sponsor was a woman named Gail Wilson, and she was from the West Hollywood, you know, area. When I got sober and I went to a lot of meetings, you know, in that part of town, I went to a lot of meetings all over the place. You know, I used to go to a lot of meetings in the Valley, and I would hitchhike out to the Valley. And, you know, I thought about this a lot, more so this last, you know, couple of months for some reason. But my sponsor, who's celebrating this month also, Bob Regan will celebrate 54 continuous years of sobriety in a couple of weeks, next week, I think, next weekend. And, you know, Bob would go to the meeting. His home group was that meeting in the valley. And I would hitchhike out there. And then they would go to coffee, and we would all go to coffee afterwards. After all the meetings back then, it seemed like all the meetings were 8:30 to 10, then people would go to coffee, and I didn't have any place else to go that was indoors again, like I said. So I'd sit with whoever was sitting at coffee. And then when coffee was done, I'd go outside and I would hitchhike the 20 miles back or the 15 miles back to where I lived, so that I'd just walk the beach until the next meeting. And Bob used to see me hitchhiking, and he would call his wife and he would say, I'm going to be late. And he would drive me that 15 miles to where I was going, even though it was 15 miles out of his way. And then he would drive back. And, you know, the funny thing for me is that people in Alcoholics Anonymous were as kind then in 1972 as I believe that they are today. But I wasn't really able to accept a lot of the kindness. And so people would offer to give me a ride, but I would not accept rides. And I would not ask for rides, certainly. But for some reason, if I was outside hitchhiking and they picked me up, then I would get in the car. I haven't figured out what my thought process was with that. But I'm particularly grateful, you know, that my sponsor took the time to do that. So did a lot of other members. And, you know, I was saying to Mark today, it's just, you know, it's one of the many examples of how people in Alcoholics Anonymous cared way more about me than I cared about myself for a long, long, long time. And I really do love in Alcoholics Anonymous that you don't have to believe this will work for it to work. You know, if you do what we do and you ask for help and you don't drink no matter what, this is a program that works, and we do have a solution, you know. So when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I had a bad attitude. I hated everything about myself. I had always hated everything about myself from my earliest memories. And I hated everything when I got here and I was sober. I didn't like being tall. I didn't like being skinny. I didn't like having curly red hair. I didn't like being from Venice. I didn't like my mother. I didn't like the way that I'd grown up. I didn't like anything about my life. I dropped out of seventh grade. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, people were guessing my age at 37. I was actually 13, but I felt 2000. And I've been sober continually since I was 13 years old. The weird thing about it, you know, it's like another one of those amazing things, is that I feel younger tonight than I did when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's a pretty damn good deal, I'll tell you. And I don't know how that happened exactly. I really don't. You know, how do you take someone who's 2,000 years old, you know, who feels 2,000? What could you possibly do? What could be in the book? Or, you know, how could sweeping a floor after a meeting, how could making coffee, you know, how could giving somebody a ride to a meeting, how could that change that you feel 2,000 years old and hate everything about yourself? I don't know exactly. I really don't. I can't tell you all of, you know, the way that it has happened. But I do believe that, as it says in the foreword to the 12 and 12, that these spiritual principles that we learn about in the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous and in service in Alcoholics Anonymous, they're designed to allow the sufferer to be free from the compulsion to drink and to be happily and usefully whole. And I have had that psychic transformation here in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it has been very, very slow. And I have made a lot of mistakes, and I have been a flawed human being. And I'm so grateful that Bill Wilson, you know, was a flawed human being. You know, that really helps me feel better. To know that, you know, that he made a lot of mistakes, but he didn't drink no matter what. And I know that that works here, because that's been proven true for me and for most of the people that I've gotten close to in Alcoholics Anonymous. No one I know has done it perfectly, but if we don't drink no matter what and we stay close, you know, we help each other. If we ask for help, you know, we find a guide who can lead us and show us what they did, so that we don't have to live the way that we used to live and feel the way that we used to feel. But that did take a long time here, you know, for me. I'm going to go ahead and I want to talk a little bit about my my first sponsor, Gail Wilson. So Gail was one of the people that I always think about when I think about that line in the book where it says we are people who normally would not mix. And you know, I know Leslie heard me sharing about this just the other day, but Gail was three times my age when she became my sponsor. She had come from a warm and loving family that just adored her. I really hated people like that. She was from the South. I didn't like people from the South. She had a car. I didn't like people who had cars. We didn't have a car. She had an education. I dropped out in seventh grade. I didn't like people with an education. She had traveled all over the world, flying, being a stewardess, and la-di-da. You know, I had run away once from Venice hitchhiking and had made it like 5 miles east to Culver City. So that was the extent of my geographic, you know, before I came to AA. And the only, you know, Gail not only did not use the language that I used, she really did not know what a lot of the profanity I was using meant. I mean, she really was clueless. And in addition, she was seen in public on many occasions wearing pink. And I did not even sit in a row where someone wore pink until I was like 10 years sober, you know, because I just didn't want people thinking I was not tough and that I was, you know, feminine or anything. But anyway, Gail became my sponsor. And I was, you know, I was a mess. And, you know, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have a place to live. I didn't have any family that wanted anything to do with me. I didn't have an education. And Gail wanted me to go back to high school. And I tried briefly to go back to high school. But if I felt 2,000 in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I just want to let you know I felt 3,000 when I went to school with these people who were allegedly my age. But like, it was just a whole different world. I couldn't do it. Or I wouldn't do it. I don't know. I mean, maybe a combination. So Gail said, all right, fine. You don't want to get a high school education to better your life? Then go ahead and get the kind of jobs you can get with a seventh grade education. And that's what I did. And I got a lot of crappy jobs. And I got fired a lot because I was a terrible employee. But I went to lots and lots of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just kept getting other jobs. And eventually, Gail found out about some kind of a program where I could get some kind of an education without going to high school. And she signed me up for a typing class. I started out typing 37 words a minute with 19 errors. And, you know, I went on and, you know, after like, I don't know, a year of typing one day at a time, I mean, I never improved. It was just awful. And they finally said, you know, you're not going to make it as a secretary. And I'd always known that. I didn't want to be a secretary. You know, I wanted to be tough and not let anybody hurt me. But anyway, I also wanted a job and I wanted to eat. So, you know, I went ahead and finished that class and they said, you know, we think you could file. We think you could get a job filing because you seem to be pretty good with the alphabet. So I got a job and it was at an insurance company. And I thought that's the kind of thing your sponsors love. I mean, it's very square, you know, very citizen-y. And I, you know, put on these clothes that looked like a citizen. I felt like, look at the little Venice broad dressing in the citizen costume to go to work. But I would put these clothes on and I'd go to work with these citizen-y people. And on the seventh day, they called me in the office. I figured they were going to maybe give me a raise and they fired me. They told me I didn't have enough experience. And not only that, I didn't have any common sense whatsoever. And I didn't know what common sense was, but I was deeply hurt. I was always deeply hurt. I didn't have any other level of being hurt. I only get deeply hurt. So, you know, I went downstairs. I didn't have a car or anything. And I called the LA Central office and I reported this company because I didn't think they would be allowed to fire us sober. I thought we'd picket, you know, do something to, you know, let them know we weren't going to stand for this sort of thing. And they just laughed and, you know, told me to go get a different job. So anyway, meanwhile, I wanted to get a driver's license and you can only get that in California if you take driver's ed if you're under 18. So you can't do that unless you go to high school. I wasn't going to high school, but I found out about this at Santa Monica City College. They were offering that class. And so I was a couple years sober, I guess 3 years sober. And I went to take that class to get a driver's license. While I was there, I heard them talking in the lobby. And some of the people were talking about something they called a dummy English class. And at that point, at 3 years sober, if you asked me to read the fifth chapter in a meeting, I could read every word and you'd hear all the words. But I could not hold a whole sentence in my head and remember what I had just read. And I was 3 years sober. I thought I had really done permanent damage to my brain. I couldn't remember anything. And I was scared. And I thought, I wonder if I take a dummy English class, if maybe I could help my memory, if maybe I could read the big book better and get better. So I signed up for that class too. And I took those two classes. And by this time, I'd found a garage that I could rent for $40 a month. And the guy owned the apartment building next door, so he gave me a key at the swimming pool so I could use the restroom over there. And not too long after that, I was able to save up enough money to buy a car. And and so I was going to school and I was working all these different jobs that I could get, you know, cleaning apartments or, you know, eventually working in restaurants or doing whatever, and going to, I took some more classes at school, and I took some more classes. And after 3 years, I think it was, they called me in the office and they told me I'd completed all the requirements for what they called an AA college degree, which I thought was a great name for a college degree. You know, I thought you guys would really like that sort of thing. I'd never planned on getting one, but I did. And along the way, after that, I'd, you know, gotten, I'd found out about getting a GED, so I'd have an equivalent to a high school diploma. And so I took those classes and I did that. And then my sponsor, Gail, was very practical. You know, by then I'd come up with a dream, and I don't know when I got it, but Gail said, you know, if you have a dream, you got to do the footwork that anybody in or out of Alcoholics Anonymous has to do to make a dream come true. You know, you can't just sit at the club or sit in an AA meeting and hope that your dream will come true. You got to do some footwork. So I did that footwork, and I got accepted to a university, and I went on to that university. And I went there for a couple years, and I finished there. And then I still had to do more footwork if I wanted my dream to come true. And I went ahead and I did that footwork, and I got a telegram. It's been over 40 years now. Saying that I'd been chosen as one of 300 out of 3,000 applicants to go to law school. And, you know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had always planned on spending a lot of time in court, but never on that side of the table, you know. And today I have a job as an attorney, and I have a job where I truly believe I'm able to be of service. I have a job where not one day do I ever go to work in all these years where I'm not reminded of where alcoholism takes people like me. And I know it doesn't take everybody to the same places, but I know the places it takes people like me, you know, and I believe I'm able to be of service, you know, in that job because of the things that I've learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous and because I've stayed sober. And, you know, right before I was graduating from law school, it became very clear that my sponsor, Gail Wilson, was dying of cancer. We'd known that she had cancer for a while. She was 48 years old when she died. And so I spent a lot of time visiting her at Cedars Hospital, and so did a lot of other people, but I would visit her. And, you know, when I would go and visit her, we ended up having some conversations, you know, and I asked her, I go, hey, Gail, how come you agreed to be my sponsor? She goes, oh, that's an easy one. She goes, because I was taught to never say no to an AA request. She said, because when I met you and when I talked with you, she said, I knew with your background and your attitude that you were never going to make it. She said, I was sure it wasn't going to work for you. She said, but I was told to not say no to an AA request, so I agreed to sponsor you. And she said, and I've sponsored many, many women. I think it was in the hundreds. I don't remember for sure. She said, many, many women. She said, I don't think I've ever sponsored a bigger flake than you. She said, I'm pretty sure you were really the worst. You know, she said, you didn't listen to so many of the things that I told you to do or to not do. You were just, you know, wild and crazy, and you got fired all the time, and you didn't, you know, you just were terrible at everything except for one thing. You always kept your AA commitments. That's the only thing that you did besides not drinking. You know, everything else, you were a total flake. You dated who I told you not to date. You didn't stop dating the people I told you to stop dating. You didn't keep the jobs I told you to keep. I mean, you know, whatever it was. And she said, and I remember when you told me you were going to take those first classes at school. She said, I knew you wouldn't finish. She goes, you'd never finished anything. I don't think you'd gone to work 5 days in a row without coming up with an excuse or, you know, feeling sorry for yourself and calling in sick or leaving late or going home early or whatever it was. You always had something, you know. And she said, so I didn't think you'd finish those classes, but you did. And she said, and then you took a few more classes. And she said, you know, I don't remember exactly when it was. She said, but I remember you called me up and you said, Gail, I think I want to be an attorney. And she said, I had to force myself not to laugh out loud. She goes, I knew that was 7 or 8 years of school. You hadn't even gone to work 5 days in a row. She goes, you know, I knew you couldn't do it. And we talked about, you know, how come Gail didn't tell me? How come she didn't say, hey, let's wake up. Let's look at you. Let's look at where you came from. Let's look at the way that you've lived your life. Let's be practical. Why don't we pick something else that you could really do? How come she didn't tell me that? And I want to be really clear here, particularly for those of you who are new, or if you happen to be in one of the long, dark hallways that each of us sometimes find ourselves along the way. Gail never believed in June in those early years. Gail never thought, oh, this is my best sponsee. Oh, she's going to do something good. Gail didn't believe that at all. But Gail always believed in Alcoholics Anonymous. Gail had seen incredible things happen in her life and in the lives of other people as she had watched and as she had stayed sober and continued to be of service and, you know, to continue to try to do things here. And so that's why she didn't tell me that it couldn't happen, because she didn't know what could happen if I showed up and I did the footwork and I didn't drink no matter what. And I, of course, have absolutely no idea what's going to happen in anybody else's journey when I walk along with people that I'm sponsoring or that I'm friends with. I don't know. I don't even know a lot of the times where my journey, you know, is going to take me. But I'm very, very grateful for the old timers and the people that have stayed sober in Alcoholics Anonymous no matter what. I can tell you that in the 48 years I have been sober, it's hard for me to imagine anything that has ever happened that I do not know someone in Alcoholics Anonymous to have walked through and stayed sober. And I'm not saying I've done that. I'm talking about the many, many, many people that I have walked with and those who walked before me, who I have watched walk through incredibly difficult circumstances. And I have watched them show up and usually do it with a lot of dignity and thankfully frequently with a sense of humor, you know. And so I know that Alcoholics Anonymous works. Bill Wilson talks about in his story, this is a design for living that works through the certain rough spots ahead, which seems to imply that maybe each of us will have some rough spots ahead, you know. But at the same time, you know, as I mentioned in the foreword to the 12 and 12, you know, these principles are designed to help us happily, you know, feel happily and usefully whole, not just usefully whole, but happily and usefully whole. And I'm checking, you know, my timer here. You know, I think that one of my favorite pieces of literature in Alcoholics Anonymous, which I know Leslie's going to smile because 2 days ago she was at a meeting and I said something else, was, so it changes like minute to minute around here. But one of my favorite things is, you know, is in the final talk, you know, that Dr. Bob shared at the 1950, you know, International Convention. And he talks about in there, I'm not going to do the whole thing because I want to go ahead and read you something else in a minute, but he talks about, you know, let us all not forget to stick out our hand and to be kind and to help someone in the way that we were helped, you know. And I think so often these days, I sometimes hear people in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous get very, very caught up in the specific language of a step, or the specific language on a page in the Big Book or in the 12 and 12 or in any of our literature. And I certainly know that those things are important. That those things are a part of how we have the psychic change. But I also believe that most of us don't remember the first thing that someone said at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't remember some of the things that were first read at the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. But we remember kindness. We remember someone coming over and shaking our hand or giving us a half a cup of coffee because they know that we're so sick we probably can't have a full cup without spilling it. Or they get us a seat. Or maybe they get our phone number and they call and check on us to see if we want to go to another meeting the next day. And those are the things that we do a lot of times for the new people. But I just want to mention that, you know, during these times right now, obviously this is everybody's first pandemic, so we don't have a lot of experience, you know, to fall back on. But I know, and I know that probably all of you know, there are a lot of people who are really having a hard time in different ways, you know, and it's not just because of COVID, you know, it's not that they're all sick with the virus, although we probably all know people who are. That's one thing that's going on. But it's more that there are people who perhaps they've lost someone in their family that just died from regular reasons, you know, the way that people might have died anyway, but we can't go sit with them, or they can't be in the hospital with the person that they love because, you know, just because of these circumstances. And some of these people don't have, you know, some of our members that have been sober a long time, they don't have an iPad or a computer, or they don't know how to use it. So maybe we could, you know, think about our kindness for the alcoholic who still suffers by making a phone call or sending a card or telling a joke, you know, or whatever it could be. You know, the thing that I read the other day when I was at the meeting that I want to just read to you real quick. It's really important for me. A couple people on here that I sponsor, they know I've been telling them about this page, but it really helps me reset because sometimes I have to start my day over often lately when I feel overwhelmed, you know, with sadness about things that are going on in the world or in my own family or in yours, you know, if I care about you. We've been speaking to you of serious, sometimes tragic things. We've been dealing with alcohol in its worst aspect, but we aren't a glum lot. If newcomers could see no joy or fun in our existence, they wouldn't want it. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. And this is the part I have to keep reading. We try not to indulge in cynicism over the state of the nations, nor do we carry the world's troubles on our shoulders. I'm going to tell you this last thing. I was at a meeting at my home group a few years ago, and a guy shared that his sponsor said, "We don't go into the dark to help the people that we love who are in the darkness. We stand in the light so that they can come out and find us." Thank you for letting me be part of your meeting today, and please stay in the light.